From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1970. President Nixon convincing George Bush, a member of Congress, to run for the Senate, and a political career nearly ended before it even really began to flower. You see, George H.W. Bush was going to run for Senate and beat this guy who was known as, quote, a nut, Ralph Yarborough, for the Senate seat. But it didn't quite work out that way. You see, Yarborough lost in the primary to another, perhaps a liberal, but not quite as nutty, according to the political establishment. That man's name was Lloyd Benson. And Nixon, who had encouraged Bush to run, saying that he would win, all of a sudden had a loss on his hands. George H.W. Bush losing to Benson in 1970, 53.4 to 46.6. It was just one of several near-death political experiences for George H.W. Bush. But of course we know anyone who thought his political career then was over was wrong. It eventually led to the vice presidency and the White House for one term, though Kurt Smith probably thinks it should have been two. Kurt Smith is here. He's the author of a new book on George H.W. Bush. The book is called George H.W. Bush, Character at the Core. The book is out now. Kurt is a senior lecturer of English at the University of Rochester. He's written 16 books and was a speechwriter for, among other people, George H.W. Bush. Nice to have you here, Kurt.
Evan, a delight to be with you.
Well, I started there because I took great delight in reading your book and seeing all the little points in the road where it looked like his career might be over. And there was one. How sweet, by the way, that it nearly ends for him in 1970, and then he gets to run against Benson on the national
ticket
in 1988.
He was a dead duck, a gone goose in 1970. He had expected to win. Yarborough was very unpopular with the Main Street populace of Texas, and unpopular enough that, as you suggest, Benson beat him. And Benson was a cattleman, he was an oilman, he was a multimillionaire, very hard to stigmatize as a liberal. And so Bush found a moving target in the general election, and very frustrating for him. And Nixon campaigned for him in Texas. It didn't help, enough at least. And as you suggest, without Richard Nixon, we would never have heard, I think it fair to say, of George Bush, certainly not on the national stage. But Nixon picked him up. Nixon really was his mentor in the 1960s and the 1970s, early 70s, and gave him the job of ambassador to the United Nations. And this began the foreign policy education of George Herbert Walker Bush. And how ironic and how apt fitting it was that Richard Nixon began that process, because I would suggest that the two most brilliant foreign policy presidents of the last at least half century, dating back to Franklin Roosevelt, were Richard Nixon and George H.W. Bush.
Now, the interesting thing about George H.W. Bush's career, even through the presidency and through the 1992 campaign, was that there were some Republican voters who never felt that he was a true conservative or a true GOP stalwart. And that's the irony I have looking back, because, Kurt, I get the sense, and if there are any conservative stalwarts I know, you are among them, that you view him very favorably among those terms.
Well, I do, but keep in mind, I had the great privilege and pleasure of working with him on a one-on-one personal basis. And I did so 4 years in the White House, writing more speeches for him than anyone. And then from 1994 through 97, after we were asked to leave the White House by the American public, I tell people they haven't lived until they've been fired by the country. I headed Bush's speech staff for the next 3 years. So I got to work with him intimately, really, for 7 years, and you know, have written speeches for him ever since. So I know him to be a conservative. A lot of my fellow Republicans, or perhaps I call myself a former Republican, so we'll call it erstwhile Republicans, they look at Bush and they see a Yaley, they see Skull and Bones, the secret society, they see someone who is a millionaire himself, they see someone who, in their view, is an elitist, they see someone who was in his early years, at least, pro-abortion, and they say, you know what, he's not one of us. The irony, again, of Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon had a very moderate voting record. Richard Nixon had a very liberal, in fact, record domestically, you could argue, as president of the United States. But conservatives across this country embraced Nixon as one of us. Because why? Because he came from a dirt poor background. Because he worked his way up. Because he was Horatio Alger meet Walter Mitty. I think in politics, particularly as in life, background means a lot. In some cases, it means everything. And it did in the early years, at least, between conservatives and Bush.
If you're going to pick up this book, and for our audience, let me say that everyone's got a bit of a different view on politics, but if you consider yourself a conservative, you're going to pick up this book and find yourself cheering at many points, and not just with the stories told, but some of the analysis of the electorate. If you are considering yourself a progressive, this is a beautiful crystallization of the way conservatives view, I think, governing, campaigning, just the very notion of almost chivalry in politics that seems to have gone by the wayside. So it's a very interesting book for no matter your political background. Let me put it that way. But let me also ask Kurt, why now with this book? I mean, this is a time where we've got George W. Bush writing about his father.
Yes, you noticed.
And I'm I'm sure you and George W. Bush were coordinating closely, right?
Yes, we're very close.
Yeah, right.
I am much more hospitable to the policies and the persona of the dad than the son. I think in many ways they're polar opposites. It's no secret that the father's favorite, if you would, although he loves both equally, and parents will understand this, even if you do, you have a favorite. His favorite is Jeb Bush. Barbara's favorite is W. And, you know, they have joked in the family that that is the case. And Jeb is more subtle, more tender, more endearing, perhaps, than W. And the dad is much the same. I think readers who purchase or read from a friend this book, George H.W. Bush, character at the core. And character is the core of this man. Honor, you mentioned that term. This man was brought up in an age and a time and a family of duty, honor, country. It is no accident that on Pearl Harbor Day, the 7th of December, 1941, that at the age of 17, he had had friends of his die at Pearl Harbor. George H.W. Bush, the next day, what does he do? He goes to the enlistment office, and he wants to enlist.
At the age of 17.
At the age of 17, which is why, in fact, the officers there put, a hand on his head and said, "Son, you have to wait until you're 18. He did. Impatiently, he enlisted at 18. He became the Navy's youngest bomber pilot. And Bush, 2 years later, almost lost his life. He was a war hero in every sense of the term, and also was too modest to talk about being a war hero, which endears him even more. So,
much to the chagrin of some of his speechwriters?
Much to the chagrin. In fact, we fought a running battle for 4 years. I am sure this is the only politician of which this is true in American history. He hated to use the word I. Now, you try to give a political speech without using the word I, because it smacked too much of what his mother, who taught him so much, particularly in terms of faith and conduct and behavior, his mother Dorothy would say to him, "Now, George, none of that how great thou art business," referring to the great Protestant hymn. And she molded him into the person that he became, which is, you know, you use the term chivalry. You know, he almost, in fact, reminds me of a knight in that sense. There is a chivalry. There is a nobility. There is an honor and an honesty that pervades everything he does. It hurt him politically to a great extent, as maybe we can talk about. But on a personal level, he is the single most honorable politician and among the most honorable human beings that I have ever met. And no, he will not be mistaken, at least in my lexicon, for George W. Bush.
Do you, at the same time as the writer, have to be careful to write biography and not hagiography. I mean, there's a few lines here, Kurt, that are, I mean, your appreciation and admiration for this man is very, very clear, and certainly for his family. Mm-hmm. I mean, even Dorothy, you talk about when they went to China, and you said, you write, quote, "Missing America, the Bushes loved the Chinese, mannered and hardworking. Dorothy Bush could have mothered them all."
Oh, I don't think there's anything hyperbolic about that sentence at all. They felt a cultural affinity. I know the Bushes did. I'm not sure that Dorothy Bush ever went to China. She may have. Her husband was, of course, a United States senator from Connecticut. But I have Chinese students, other Oriental students in my classes at the University of Rochester. And to a man and woman, they are hardworking, they are well-mannered, they are shy, they are courteous. They're every adjective that I just used and more. And no, there's nothing hyperbolic about that at all. But those traits don't carry you very far in politics. So you've got, as I talk about in the book, you've got this extraordinary, not miscasting as you would, but this war that Bush must wage in a profession which says to him, you can only get ahead by throwing aside the judgments and the values that you were taught when you were young. Well, he refused to do that. As I said, he would literally go through speeches and he would cross out the word "I," and you know, well, as I said, you know, try to write a speech in the third person, anything that we would have that was at the least immodest, he would cross out. You know, particularly his war record. I remember as a kid in 1960, John F. Kennedy and his handlers made great use of the fact that he too was a war record in the Solomons in 1943, and a PT-9. In fact, they had a PT-9 pin that all the Kennedy staffers wore, and it became a badge of honor. Bush never, ever referred on his own to his war service and his war record. In 1992, when we surreptitiously, as it were, tried to smuggle a reference to his service into speeches, Bush took it out totally, and in fact would make fun of it. For example, in 1988, when he was running, this is before me, Peggy Noonan may have inserted it because she worked in the campaign, and there was a reference to Bush's mother, Dorothy, who said, "Now, George, I hear you've been bragging about your war record." And Bush says, "No, ma'am." And he says, "Well," she said, "Well, you make sure you don't." And he says, "Yes, ma'am." And he didn't for the rest of the campaign. And I don't think he did even before then. But it just goes to show you how forged she was by her. So, and there's a dichotomy, a very clear dichotomy in this book between the private Bush, who is, you know, of sterling character, and the politician Bush, who is, as I say in the book, a pedestrian politician at best and a lousy politician at worst.
And a hesitant brawler, and we're going to talk about that coming up here. But before we even get there, back to Nixon, I think some people will learn in this book, and again, the book is called George H.W. Bush, Character at the Core by Kurt Smith. It's out now. For those of us who don't know the relationship, it was a very interesting and close relationship, and as a foreign policy president that he became, so much of that seemed to hinge on the post he ended up with when he lost that Senate race in 1970.
Nixon made George Bush, and I'm not being at all critical of Bush, because he made the most of his opportunities, but the opportunities were made possible through Nixon. Nixon liked Bush. He liked his manners. He liked his family. He liked, I think, the religious faith. Nixon was brought up in a very, very religious Quaker household where he went to church four times a day on Sunday. So there was that melding. He liked how Bush was a comer. He thought that he had a great future in the Republican Party. And he would have very early on if Bush had won in 1970, as he thought he would, and as Nixon encouraged him to run because Nixon thought that Yarborough would be nominated. So I think Nixon felt a sense of guilt. And he also thought that Bush could do him some good as ambassador to the United Nations in New York, because Bush had an engaging personality. And meeting him, it was very easy for you to be charmed by him. That was something that Nixon always, of course, found it difficult for him to do. And so he becomes ambassador to the United Nations. And then he becomes, after that, head of the Republican National Party. And this is where the relationship with Nixon becomes very Byzantine. In 1971 and 72, the relationship between Nixon and Bush is at its Mount Everest, at its high water mark. Nixon goes to China, and Bush is in the United Nations when this is going on, and when Bush has to smooth relations with Taiwan, which is losing its seat in the United Nations. But moreover, the world basically applauds Richard Nixon, career anti-communist, going to China and ending more than a quarter century of estrangement with between the nation's greatest power, us, and the nation's most populous power, the People's Republic of China. And Bush basked in the afterglow of that. Who would not? And at that point, he admired Richard Nixon enormously. And then, of course, came Watergate. And he had the bad timing to have accepted Nixon's offer to become head of the Republican National Committee.
And I wonder at this point, Kurt, in reading the book, are you too willing to excuse a little bit of naivete? And look, let me read from what both Reagan and Bush said at the time about that. Reagan, of course, governor of California, says at the time, someday, quote, someday I think people will look back at Watergate and say, now what was that all about? George H.W. Bush would say about Watergate, I just never thought that the president would lie. I mean, doesn't that speaks to naivete?
Well, possibly a tad, although, again, keep in mind that the relationship with the Nixon family. With Pat Nixon, who was a great first lady, with the Nixon daughters, whom Gerald Ford said in his mini inaugural address, any president would be proud to have daughters of this loyalty, and that's true, I think, no matter what your politics. Relationship at this point was almost familial between the two of them, the two families. So it's pretty hard to admit that. To yourself that you've been wrong about someone that you have admired so much. Reagan had admired Nixon greatly, and he was a loyalist with Nixon to the end. And nothing wrong with that. We have too little loyalty in politics. And, you know, this was after, a decade after Watergate, and Reagan was saying, someday I think people will look back and say, what was it all about? And frankly, you know, people will look back even now in terms of the cause of it. Why did Nixon become entwined and so forth? There are a lot of questions to this day that have not been answered. So I think that I can understand at least why both of them felt the way they did. Reagan was quite literally the last Republican, along with Bush, to demand Nixon's resignation in 1974.
And when it comes to what followed there, it was a New York governor, Rocky, who, again, on along the list of things that could have ended or really stalled or changed George H.W. Bush's political career, here's another moment. Who's going to be the vice president?
Yeah, and Bush thought that he might get the job, or perhaps would get the job. And Gerald Ford, who had succeeded Nixon, it came down to basically Nelson Rockefeller or George Bush. And, you know, he chose, to his everlasting regret, Nelson Rockefeller, because Rockefeller was much more liberal than the average Republican. And he had to, at least in his own mind, ask Rockefeller to step aside himself within a year so that Bob Dole could become vice president. This never would have happened. He would have been very happy with the quintessential vice president, as Bush showed when he served Ronald Reagan brilliantly for 8 years in the 1980s. And I think perhaps Ford might have won that in 1976, because he certainly would have won Texas, which was very close, against Carter. He would have had Bush on the ticket. He would have won perhaps a couple other southern states, and that's all it would have taken for him to have won re-election.
We could spend all day on just the political campaigns, which I found so fascinating, all the little vignettes that Kurt shares in the book, some of the behind-the-scenes conversations. Here's one I did not know, and as someone who is a student of history, I probably should have known, but I took great delight in how Ronald Reagan ended up choosing George H.W. Bush. Because, first of all, before we get to that moment, and it all happened quickly, let's backtrack a bit to the campaign, because was it Nashua, New Hampshire, that there was a debate. And you talk about a moment that swings the campaign, and frankly, a moment that could have severed the relationship between Reagan and Bush. It was there.
Well, politics can pivot on the darndest thing, and this was true in Nashua, New Hampshire. Reagan had lost the Iowa caucus, which is a stunner because he had been Dutch Reagan, the baseball and football announcer on WOC. In Des Moines in the 1930s. He was almost a local boy, and he loses the caucus to Bush. They then go to neighboring, for Bush, New Hampshire, right next to where he was born. The polls showed that the momentum, Bush said, Big Mo, was now with him. And had Bush won New Hampshire, he would have undoubtedly been the Republican nominee. Whether he could have beaten Carter or not, I don't know. We don't know. It's like throwing a darts into the fog. But what happened was this. The debate was going to occur in Nashua, New Hampshire, between Reagan and Bush.
Right.
And the Reaganites decided that they would, sponsor the debate. So Reagan chose the ground rules. And the ground rules were a two-man debate, himself and Governor Bush, or this would be rather Ambassador Bush, I guess would have been his highest title at that point. And so this is what, Governor Reagan expected as he approached the pivotal debate in Nashua. Well, the Nashua paper got cold feet because they didn't like the idea of being in this debate where Reagan, one of the combatants, was paying for it. So they decided that they would pay for it. And the ground rules changed. And Bush, showing unusual political dexterity and wanting to split the vote against Reagan, because this was his big hope to unseat the Gipper and win a second straight primary, thereby invited all the rest of the candidates in the field in New Hampshire, including Howard Baker and Phil Crane and several others. So you had about six candidates all standing there, and in one spot, and Ronald Reagan in the other. And he was dumbfounded. He thought he had been done dirty by Bush and, frankly, by the newspaper. And so the newspaper editor, a fellow by the name of Mr. Bream, says to Governor Reagan, "Governor Reagan, basically sit down." And Reagan, full of righteous anger, grabs the microphone and stands up. And the newspaper editor, again, tells him to be quiet and sit down. And Reagan, who knows nothing of the backdrop here, only that he's been basically sabotaged, at least in his view, says the immortal words, "I paid for this microphone, Mr. Green." Getting the name wrong, but getting everything else theatrically right. "I paid for this microphone, Mr. Green." That's it. That's all he said. But the way he said it, never losing control, the Gipper never lost control in public. But it was so dramatic, so unexpected, and so imbued with leadership. What did Bush do? Bush sat there like the bump on the log. And those, five or six words so turned the debate in New Hampshire that Reagan went on to win the New Hampshire primary and ultimately to win the nomination, to win the Republican nomination for president
Bush
of
was
the
about
United
to get
States.
Bush was about to get run over all in that quick span. But then, Ronald Reagan has to choose a vice presidential candidate. And some notion of a Reagan-Ford dream ticket or whatever you want to call it. But It was a Walter Mondale interview.
Yeah. Cronkite.
Walter Mondale. See, I'm getting ahead of myself. Walter Cronkite.
Mondale would have wished it could have been him.
Yes, indeed. It was a Cronkite interview with Ford.
Right.
That set the scene for us, Kurt, because I found that whole scene fascinating.
Surrealistic is the word, and I go through it in the book because it, again, politics can pivot on just the most unexpected thing. Come to the convention. Reagan had been stunningly unimpressed by his first exposure to Bush. He thought he had frozen. He thought he had choked. He thought he had sat there like the little Dutch boy, you know, with his finger in the dike. And basically his thought was, I may need him to appeal to moderate Republicans, but I don't want him. He froze. So he comes to the convention. And some aides begin to say to Reagan, you know, you got the conservative vote. What you need is a big name, somebody who can get the moderate vote, even appeal to Democrats and appeal to liberals. What about Gerald Ford? And so this begins this rumor, this tsunami, which sweeps the convention, Gerald Ford to be number two to Reagan, or was it to have two number ones? Well, Walter Cronkite begins interviewing Gerald Ford, never been noted for it has for his mental dexterity, and or at least verbal dexterity, let's put it right. That way. And Ford starts talking about if he goes to Washington, he's going to do this and that. And Reagan, in his hotel suite, turns to aides. He can't believe what he's hearing. And he says to an aide, he sounds like, meaning Ford, he wants a co-presidency. And so Cronkite, as if he were listening to Reagan, uses the term co-presidency. And Ford says, I'm not talking about a co-presidency, but that's what it sounded like. And so Reagan said, I'm sure basically to himself, this cannot stand. And what he does is, he was furious. He felt sandbagged. He felt furious because he had talked to Ford about this possibility, but he had thought it was a clear delineation between number two and number one. Well, after this interview with Walter Cronkite, Ford is invited by Reagan to come over to Reagan's suite. They talk for 10 minutes, and I would have loved to have been a fly on those walls. I have a suspicion that the Gipper, for once in his life, he rarely swore even in private. But I have a feeling this might have been the exception to that rule. And they come out of the 10 minutes, and they announce that that Gerald Ford has decided that he wants to do other things. And exit Gerald Ford from the convention and from history. And Reagan turns to the telephone, dials Bush's number, and offers him the vice presidency.
Almost right there on the spot.
On the spot.
There it was. And before I get to a break, a couple of other quick points. I get the sense that as much as you admire George H.W. Bush's presidency, the most natural role he probably ever had was vice president.
No question about it. Because Bush had been taught as a child to be a good boy, to be subordinate, to try to please, not to interrupt, basically to supplement, not supplant other human beings. And that's what the vice presidency is. And you're quite right. I think he had to force himself, in a sense, to be domineering in a way that did not come natural to him to be president. The vice presidency came as naturally to him as wearing slippers that fit just right. And Reagan, who had, as I said, not known Bush well, and what he did, he wasn't impressed by, ended those 8 years as probably the biggest fan in the United States of George Herbert Walker Bush.
When it comes to that loyalty, that principle that, as you say, George H.W. Bush lived by, loyal to Reagan, it served him well. Loyal to Nixon. Do we now look back, though, and say, you were loyal to a president that hurt this country, that in many ways that loyalty is a negative reflection of character?
Well, I don't know. Are you referring to Nixon?
Yes.
Nixon also had the most brilliant foreign policy, I would argue, dating back at least to Roosevelt in the history of the United States. Nixon also gave us an extraordinarily ambitious and pioneering liberal domestic agenda. Nixon also won the biggest landslide election, if you look at all the criteria, in the history of the United States. Nixon was also a champion of the forgotten American. He gave a voice to the silent majority, people that had assumed they had no voice. Those are hardly negative things.
So we're talking to Kurt Smith, and the book is called George H.W. Bush, Character at the Core. Very short break, and we come back, we're going to move ahead to the time that some of the words we heard George H.W. Bush say came from Kurt's pen. We're also going to hear a soundbite that might have changed the 1988 election that I've pulled and Kurt writes about in the book as well. So short break and more with the author next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we look at homelessness in the city of Rochester. There's no question it's an issue, but there are debates about how best to handle it. Even within the community that cares for the homeless, there are disagreements over what helps and what might enable someone with an alcohol problem or a substance abuse problem. We look at Sanctuary Village, the city's relationship with its homeless population, and more next hour.
We all know airline travel today is rough, right?
I was actually kind of surprised when I became a flight attendant at the general rudeness and lack of caring about other people that I saw in passengers on planes.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hey, listen, how about $20 for your airline seats? That story next time on Marketplace from APM.
This evening at 6:30.
In many ways, in this conversation with Kurt Smith, we're fast-forwarding through different parts of the work and career of George H.W. Bush, and that's what a host has to do when you only have an hour, Kurt. I apologize for that.
That's okay.
But, as you say, he ends up becoming vice president to Ronald Reagan, and they, for whatever bumps and bruises they experienced in 1980, they ended up with a very good relationship. And he seeks to become a vice president going straight to the presidency, which, you know, if it feels natural and normal now, this was not a slam dunk by any means, and he had to go through a process here. Well, Dan Rather of CBS News was putting together political profiles, and George H.W. Bush was, what was it, like the 12th out of 12 or something like that, was going to be the last one, and it was Roger Ailes, eventual founder of Fox News for our audience, who was advising George H.W. Bush, be careful with Rather. He wants to hit you on Iran-Contra. This is not a real political profile. He's going to come after you. And as you write in the book, at the time, Bush thought, well, who cares, right? This has been asked and answered.
He also trusted Rather because Rather had been a very fair and objective newscaster in Houston, Texas. And Bush had known him. And he said, basically, he won't do that to me. Again, you talk about naivete. There's Bush's naivete. He won't do that to me.
And Ailes, as you write, knew that Bush would only really be at his best when he was angry. And so
they had to make him mean.
They had to make him mean. It was not natural for George H.W. Bush. And Ailes makes a comparison in the conversation with Bush in which he says, look, when Dan Rather was working in Miami, it was covering an event in Miami, he got angry that a sporting event went late into his newscast. He walked off the set. The sporting event ends and there's 6 minutes of dead air, which would not happen today. It did at the time. And Ailes tells Bush, you know, hit him with that. He wants to hit you with Iran-Contra, and he wants to highlight one slice of a long career. Would he like it if you did the same? And what's interesting is after I read the book, I went back and listened to that interview, and it took, I think it was 6.5 minutes in, that he finally gets pushed. Let's listen to that part of the interview. This is from 1988, Dan Rather and George H.W. Bush.
Because I want to talk about why I want to be president, why those 41% of the people are supporting me.
And Mr.
And
Vice President, these questions are
fair to judge a whole career. It's not fair to judge my whole career by a rehash on Iran. How would you like it if I judge your career by those 7 minutes when you walked off the set in New York? Well, now, would you like that?
Mr. Vice President,
I have respect for you, but I don't have respect for what you're doing here tonight.
Mr. Vice President, I think you'll agree that your qualification for president and what kind of leadership you would bring to the country, what kind of government you'd have, what kind
exactly.
of people to have around him is much more important than what you just referred to. I'd be happy
well,
to
Well, I want to be
that.
Judged on the whole record.
Well,
and you're not
And
giving
I'm trying
me an
to set the record straight.
You
Mr.
invited
Vice
me
president.
To come here to talk about I thought the whole record.
That's a clip of it. Now, here's what I want to ask Kurt. If you go back to 1980 that Bob Dole ran against Bush.
Yes.
And Bob Dole famously on the air was signing off an interview and yelled at George H.W. Bush, stop lying about my record.
Yeah.
Maybe thinking at the time, if I'm forceful, it sends a message of strength.
Right.
It backfired on Bob Dole.
Sure.
George H.W. Bush, that kind of moment could backfire, but it didn't for him. In fact, it worked for him.
Well, I think because of Bush's manner, even when he was uttering that marvelous put down, and you are very thorough, Mr. Evan. That was a marvelous clip. How long did it take you to locate that?
It's on YouTube. You can see the whole interview still.
Oh, you're so mechanical, so technical.
No, it's no problem.
You know, I tell you, Evan, that's marvelous. I haven't heard that, but you know, it was, I mean, that went exactly as Roger Ailes had told Bush, Bush would never have come back with that rejoinder without Ailes having talked about that in advance. But even when Bush is using what in the hands of another more Neanderthal, let us say, person might be a devastatingly vicious cut comeback, it doesn't seem that way with Bush. It seems more refined somehow. And I think that's one reason that it didn't hurt him to do that. Whereas with Dole, you expect him to club you, and he did. Only he clubbed himself in the process.
So all of a sudden things really changed in that 1988 election, and at the convention, George W. H. W. Bush's speech really, really pivoted that election. He never trailed after that. Went from down big early on to up comfortably and never trailed. And as you write in the book, there are many moments from that actual speech that you could pick out and say, well, this is a key. A lot of us in the media have focused on read my lips. And that,
right.
And do you now think he still wins that election without read my lips, no new taxes?
Well, yes, I do.
And does he lose in 92 if he didn't hang that around himself?
Probably no, he doesn't. I make the point in the book, and I do think I'm correct, that in 1988 he had trailed Michael Dukakis by 17 points, and he won by 8. Now, a lot of people have said, well, he used illegal or unethical tactics, and they were vicious. Leave that aside. I disagree, obviously, with that assessment. But it was the most ruthlessly efficient and therefore the best campaign run in modern America. It was a brilliant campaign. They went totally from the defensive to totally on the offensive. They made Michael Dukakis the issue and not George Herbert Walker Bush. And yet 4 years later against Bill Clinton, as I write, they ran the most inept campaign, the worst campaign of modern American history. Now, how can the same person be that disparate in terms of the best and the worst? Well, I think, you know, it goes to the duality of Bush that we've talked about. In 88, he gave himself over to technicians, to people who made their living in television. And basically he did as he was told. In 92, there was no one around him who had an understanding of the Bush base that he had played to so effectively in 1988. And as a result, he got 37.5% of the vote. This from the man who in March 1991, 18 months before Election Day, had Evan, a 91% approval rating. So all I can say is I knew the highest of the highs and the lowest of the lows, and so did the president.
Well, I did not know until the book that Kurt Smith himself, maybe advising the president or hopeful at the time in 1988, did not want Dan Quayle. Kurt, you wanted Antonin Scalia to be the vice president.
Well, I think, number one, he's brilliant. No one would have been making jokes about the intellectual firepower of the Bush ticket. Number two, he's conservative, but not in a way that he could be labeled as a Philistine or Paleozoic in that sense. He's just too bright. Number three,
you don't think today people make those claims about him?
I think they're totally out of the mainstream if they do. Number three, he's Italian. It's a wonderfully a numerous ethnic group. They vote Republican, but they would have voted even more Republican. And I think number four, he would have been extremely effective in the debates against Walter Mondale. And of course, as we know, or rather Lloyd Benson in 1988.
Yeah.
Talk about small world, as you just spoke of. Again, it was Bush and Benson in 1988 indirectly. But I like very much Scalia's chances against Benson in a debate. So there were a lot of reasons to like, and he was a dark horse candidate. And Bush likes surprises.
Shouldn't we, though, as American people, be uncomfortable with the notion of Supreme Court justices jumping to presidential tickets?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that there are things that eclipse partisanship, things that eclipse whether you call yourself a Democrat or a Republican. I mean, there have been people too numerous to mention, Evan, in my life that have been Democrats that I agreed with, that I liked more, that I respected more than Republicans that I knew, that I didn't respect or like at all, because there was nothing to respect.
In 1990 and 91, there was a recession.
Mm-hmm.
And
mild recession.
Well, you say mild recession in the book. I still remember my own father,
mm-hmm.
A small C conservative,
right.
Grabbing his sons in 1990 saying, "Hey, guys, just so you know."
Yeah.
We're going to have to buckle it up for a while.
Well,
and
he was
tough.
He was a visionary.
Well, but I say mild recession. Look, I think in the book, some readers, especially progressive readers, may say, mm-hmm. you credit the 1980 recovery with Reagan-style political governance,
mm-hmm.
fiscal policy, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And then you seem to absolve the recession that followed. And then you seem to want to credit the 90s growth also on sort of Reagan-style fiscal policy.
Oh, I don't absolve. I mean, you take the bitter with the sweet. And I would simply say judge the record from 1981, including the recession, which he inherited, of course, of 1981 and 1982. And then judge the bonanza from 1983 through 1990. Yes, you have a recession for the next year and a half. But then judge, the Reagan-style tax cuts and the willingness of business to invest, the confidence which Reagan had inspired, which Bush had inspired briefly, which Bill Clinton inspired, and which benefited the Democrats immensely of finally making peace, if you would, with business. And so I would say, I'm perfectly willing to look at the bumps as well as the smooth places. Over that span of really 15 to 20 years.
When you read Kurt's book, you get a sense for how some of the speeches come together, and I always love that. And I think Kurt really has a great sense for the way communication works, what works and what doesn't in politics, how you make up for someone's perceived inefficiencies, and George H.W. Bush occasionally had those. I look at that 88 convention speech, though, when he said, "Read my lips, no new taxes." And I wonder if progressive readers are going to read this and say, "Kurt, your party was addicted to the notion of taxes, taxes, taxes. It hurt George H.W. Bush in the end. He couldn't keep the promise. And even if he was a good president, why don't you look back and say, hey, we were wrong. We were wrong on that. Occasionally, taxes need to fluctuate based on the need of the time."
Well, I don't think that he did. And I don't think that, frankly, with due respect, that in politics, Crow is not edible in public places. I will say that I think that tax cutting became too much mania in the Republican Party. It became really, even more than national defense, the one thing that bound the different factions of the Republican Party. Tax cutting is fine, but there are other things that matter in finance and in life as well. In 88, though, I mean, it's not simply that. That was a beautiful speech. I can say that because I didn't write it. Peggy Noonan wrote it in relation to Bush. And it was mightily important in terms of presenting Bush. This was his coming out. This was introducing him as missions accomplished in terms of his life. The war hero, the oil catter in Texas, the foreign policy background, the family man, all of the things that you would wish to establish. And they, by and large, were true. And then, of course, the negative campaign against Dukakis. And it was enormously effective. Why? Because Dukakis did not respond. And Democrats have not made that mistake since. That lesson was seared into the soul of the Democratic Party.
You compared it to Mitt Romney in 2012, waiting too late to respond.
Yeah, I really do, because I think it's entirely true. I think it's our Mitt Romney would be president today if he had not allowed Barack Obama during the first half of 2012, in effect, to write Mitt Romney's autobiography for the American public. I mean, what were they thinking?
Well, don't you think Barack Obama would say Mitt Romney's autobiography spoke for itself?
I think it did in the best sense of that term. And I would point to you in terms of polls right now. And the prevailing thought is that the American public would vote for Mitt Romney comfortably over Barack Obama.
Kurt Smith wrote the book George H.W. Bush, Character at the Core, and you, we're losing time. And so I want to wrap with a couple of points. First of all, when you write speeches for someone, mm-hmm. you talk about how getting to know someone, getting into the rhythm, understanding how to write the language that feels comfortable to them,
yes.
that feels natural to them. You even knew when you would write for him what would make him tear up. And you tell that story. I enjoyed that story.
Well, at a convention in Hofstra a couple of years ago, one of the assistants for the Bush writers turned to me and as if she had never thought of this before, and she said, speaking to me, she said, "You were the only person who could make Bush cry," and you know, part of it was that I wrote for him in terms of military. Events, and he was always very prone to sentiment because he was a veteran himself, and part of it was because we had a commonality of value. He grew up in a rich home. I grew up in a middle class, lower middle class home here in upstate New York, but our values were the same: family, religion, patriotism, courtesy, manners, hard work. And they cross, how much your parents earn and that kind of thing. So I understood him. And, for example, the eulogy that he gave for Reagan in 2005, I wrote the speech. He had asked me to write it. And he gave the speech at National Cathedral, and he cried during that speech. And I had told my wife, Sarah, I said, this is the line. I said, he's going to cry during the speech. And this is the line that's going to make him do it. And it did. That's how well I knew him.
George H.W. Bush has always been a religious person who didn't want to wear it too outwardly. But let me close the conversation with
yes.
this, Kurt, because, again, the book is about what character means
mm-hmm.
and how George H.W. Bush embodied that in his various service, but not the least of which the presidency. He wrote in 1989, Bush wrote in a note, "The recognition of our country being one nation under God. As president, I know for fact already that one cannot be president without faith in God."
Oh, yes.
Some people will be unnerved by that.
Well, you can't say anything in America that will get 100% approval, unanimity. But what he said right there would be overwhelmingly endorsed by the American people. And that's good enough for him. And it's good enough for me.
Is it a religious test, though, that says you need a faith of some kind?
I don't believe we'll ever see in this country the day when we elect someone who doesn't believe in, as Reagan would say, the man upstairs.
Last question, Kurt, as you look back at his presidency, and again, there's so much in how things played out in 1992 and beyond. He became, after his presidency, I thought, very warm and gracious with the man who beat him,
mm-hmm.
much as Reagan was with him.
Yeah.
And I always think that is, for the country, good to see leaders willing to do that. But I think he didn't always feel forced. Do you actually think he liked Bill Clinton?
Well, he didn't know Bill Clinton. And, you know, politics, we've become so polarized that a lot of the folks who oppose one another don't know one another. That was not the case 20 to 30 years ago. So it's so interesting. I can tell you that as 2004, 2005 evolved, and it became clear that Bush and Clinton liked one another, the Bush camp was appalled by this. The Clinton camp was appalled by this. The only two people that weren't appalled were Bush and Clinton. And then, of course, we thought better of it, and we're delighted by it now. And you are absolutely right. I think it's good for the country. I think that Bush has set a wonderful standard, and Clinton has too, in terms of putting politics aside as a former president, dealing with your colleagues as brothers, uniting and getting behind bipartisan causes which can benefit the nation as a whole.
George H.W. Bush, Character at the Core, is Kurt Smith's 16th book. He is a senior lecturer of English at the University of Rochester, a former presidential speechwriter, and takes us inside so much of George H.W. Bush's life. Thanks for sharing the hour with us here.
Evan, you're so welcome. I've enjoyed it.
Well, you can find the book now. It is out now. And like I've said, no matter your political persuasion, I think it is a very instructive book. Even, hey, if you're a conservative and you love the Bushes or George H.W. Bush, there's a lot to delight in. If you're a progressive, it may drive you nuts at times, but it is tremendously revealing. Thank you, Kurt.
Thank you.
Short break and more next on Connections. Stay with us.